From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
We certainly want to reduce the level of terror, certainly not escalate it. There's one easy way to do that, and therefore it's never discussed, namely stop participating in it.
Scholar and activist Noam Chomsky looks at terrorism, its history, and how it's practiced today on U.S. soil and through U.S. policies. But first, the chief of the Postal Union in New York talks about the death of postal workers in Washington, D.C. from anthrax. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Northern Alliance asked the U.S. to hit Taliban front lines harder as U.S. bombers attacked Afghan cities and the front lines again today. This despite witness reports that a Taliban rocket slammed into the main bazaar in the opposition-held town of Charikar near the front line, killing two people, including a 60-year-old vegetable vendor. And the British newspaper The Independent is reporting that the first U.S. air raids on the Taliban front line north of Kabul missed their targets entirely and dropped bombs close to their anti-Taliban allies. The Taliban front line is difficult to identify from the air and winds its way through heavily populated villages, orchards, and vineyards. The Israeli army has assassinated a senior Hamas member and is continuing its invasion of Palestinian areas after flatly rejecting a U.S. demand for its immediate withdrawal from self-ruled towns in the West Bank. Russia has struck a multi-million-dollar arms deal with the Northern Alliance. Under the agreement, the alliance is already receiving tanks, helicopters, and anti-aircraft missiles. And here at home, two district postal workers in Washington, D.C., Joseph Kersine and Thomas Morris, have died of what appears to be anthrax after reporting to emergency rooms only hours earlier. Two others have also contracted the inhalational anthrax, and nine other people are suffering from anthrax-like symptoms and are awaiting results. The Brentwood Road Mail Center, which processes all letters sent to Congress, has become the newest epicenter of the letterborne anthrax. As the House closed and several Senate buildings shut down after some 30 people were exposed to anthrax spores from a letter to Senator Daschle, many postal workers wondered whether they should be tested and take antibiotics. But their bosses told them that the risk of exposure to the bacteria was minimal and that there was no need for antibiotics. Local postal union leaders said the two deaths might have been prevented if officials had respected workers' requests for earlier testing and antibiotic distribution. We're joined on the phone right now again by William Smith. He is president of the New York Metro Area Postal Workers Union. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
It's good to have you with us. Your reaction to and knowledge about the two men in Washington, D.C., postal workers who have just died from what appears to be anthrax?
First of all, I have to say to the nation and to the listening of this program that we have a serious crisis in our hands. I've been saying it from day one that the Postal Service have been lying to the public and lying to the American people and lying to the workers. It's a sad day that two people have to lose their lives before the Postal Service aware that they have a problem. They already knew they had a problem. I've been saying this from day one, that they knew they had a problem going all the way back into September the 18th of this year. But let me share something else with the public. The Postal Service knew they have a problem with this bacteria in the mail going all the way back in 1998 and 99, which APW and all the postal national unions have a copy of the memo that the ex-Postmaster General, Marvin Rumney, sent out, dated on November 1st, 1999, a memorandum understanding to all the managers and all the facilities throughout this country about the bacteria called anthrax in the mail back there 2 years ago. So this is not no strange thing to the Postal Service. The public don't know this, but the American people don't know it, and also the postal workers didn't know it until we got a copy of this memorandum. And we are now circulated to the media so the media can get out to the public and let them know just the kind of games that Postal Service has been paying with the work alive.
You're saying that on September 18th, I mean, it does go back before that, but there was the post office knew that there was an anthrax letter. Did you get told as representative of the workers, head of the postal union?
No. Not the leadership of the unions was told, nor was the workers was told. The only way we found out about it, it was by the news media, just like the public found out by the news media.
And what are you demanding right now?
Well, I'm going to demand that these workers got to be tested. That's the first place. We demanded the second thing, the most important thing, should I say, if they followed our memorandum of understanding they put out in 1998 and 1999, that they were supposed to shut down these facilities, test these employees, test the machinery, and the air samples. They are supposed to do all these things, but which they signed and agreed to do once they found out they had this problem in 1998 and 1999. They are not even following the procedure they set up by CDC back in 1980 and 1999.
You represent...
I can gladly... any news media a copy of the memorandum they put out.
You represent the postal workers at Rockefeller Plaza, where the letter would have passed through to Tom Brokaw. What kind of precautions are being taken there? Have all the workers, both the letter carriers and the postal workers and the post office, been tested?
Well, my understanding, all my workers were tested. I do know that, the one that I represent. I don't know about the carriers. And I don't know about the mail handlers over there.
And that's only in the last few days that they were tested?
They were tested last Friday. That's correct.
After you had your news conference?
That's correct.
And what are you demanding right now in terms of protective gear, what postal workers should know? You have talked about an evacuation plan.
Well, that's correct. Number one, we do believe that they are only doing a random testing in Morgan. They have areas facility they know they had a problem with. They do believe that letters came through those facilities, with the letters with the NBC and also the letters that were sent to CBS. They do believe that those letters was in that was came through either five of those facilities. Now they talking about doing random testing in those facilities. I have a problem with random testing based on the fact that somebody might slip through the cracks. We do believe that all the employees must be tested in those facilities. Secondly, the most important thing is that they are also telling the employees got to almost still demand to get gloves. They should automatically have the gloves on the workflow when the employees punch in to go to work and the respirator. The employees got to ask for gloves and got to ask for them about four or five times. A lot of times they got demand to get the gloves. Before they have to say to the supervision that I'm not going to work until I get some gloves, and that's when they give them gloves.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, William Smith, president of the New York Metro Postal Workers Union, and we will certainly come back to the story as the latest news. Two D.C. postal workers, Joseph Kersine and Thomas Morris, have died of what appears to be anthrax, and there is a third and fourth postal worker who is believed to have it now. Thanks for being with us. You are listening to the War and Peace Report.
Mother, 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 there's far too many of you crying. Oh, we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Father, 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 we don't need to escalate. War is not the answer.
What's Going On by Marvin Gaye, sung by Richie Havens, here on the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from Ground Zero, the first Ground Zero, Afghanistan being the second. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. planes pounded Taliban frontline positions north of Kabul and near a strategic northern city today for a third successive day, as the Afghan opposition says they intend to surround and eventually take the capital of Kabul. The Taliban accused U.S. forces of killing more than 100 people in a hospital in an earlier raid. Taliban officials say hundreds of civilians have been killed, thousands wounded in President Bush's so-called war on terrorism. Among the allies the U.S. is enlisting in the so-called war is Russia, which has killed thousands of civilians in Chechnya. Then there's China, which is currently arresting and killing Muslim dissidents in the country's northwestern provinces. Turkey, which has killed thousands of Kurds and destroyed hundreds of villages in an effort to wipe out Kurdish resistance. And Indonesia, home of one of the world's most brutal militaries, which has killed thousands of people in Aceh and West Papua, hundreds of thousands of in East Timor. It's an irony that would have made George Orwell proud. Some of the biggest sponsors of state terror enlisted in the fight against terrorism and using the fight against terrorism to justify their own crimes. One might be forgiven for wondering just what kind of terrorism the U.S. is interested in wiping out. Well, we turn now to Professor Noam Chomsky for that answer. This past week, he gave a major address on terrorism, its history, and how it's practiced today on U.S. soil and through U.S. policies. Today, we'll spend the first hour of the War and Peace Report hearing that speech. This is Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and one of the world's leading scholars and critics of U.S. foreign policy.
I'm going to assume two conditions for this talk. The first one is what I assume to be a recognition of fact, that is that the events of September 11th were a horrendous atrocity, probably the most devastating instant human toll of any crime in history outside of war. The second has to do with the goal. Second assumption has to do with the goal. I'm assuming that our goal is that we're interested in reducing the likelihood of such crimes, whether they're against us or against someone else. If you don't accept those two assumptions, then what I say will not be addressed to you. If we do accept them, then a number of questions arise, closely related ones, which merit a good deal of thought. One question, and by far the most important one, is what is happening right now? Implicit in that is what we can do about it. Second, has to do with the very common assumption that what happened on September 11th is a historic event, one which will change history. I tend to agree with that. I think it's true. It was a historic event. And the question we should be asking is exactly why. A third question has to do with the title, the War Against Terrorism. Exactly what is it? And there's a related question, namely, what is terrorism? Fourth question, which is narrower but important, has to do with the origins of the crimes of September 11th. And the fifth question that I want to talk a little about is what policy options there are in fighting this war against terrorism and dealing with the situations that led to it. Say a few things about each. Glad to go beyond in discussion, or don't hesitate to bring up other questions. These are the ones that come to my mind as prominent, but you may easily and plausibly have other choices. Well, let's start with right now. I'll talk about the situation in Afghanistan. I'll just keep to uncontroversial sources like the New York Times. According to the New York Times, there are 7 to 8 million people in Afghanistan on the verge of starvation. That was true. September 16th, the Times reported, I'm quoting it, that the United States demanded from Pakistan the elimination of truck convoys that provide much of the food and other supplies to Afghanistan's civilian population. As far as I could determine, there was no reaction in the United States, or for that matter in Europe. I was on national radio all over Europe the next day. There was no reaction in the United States or in Europe, to my knowledge, to the demand to impose massive starvation on millions of people. The threat of military strikes right after September, around that time, forced the removal of international aid workers that crippled the assistance programs. Actually, I'm quoting again from the New York Times. Refugees reaching Pakistan after arduous journeys from Afghanistan are describing scenes of desperation and fear at home as the threat of American-led military attacks turns their long-running misery into a potential catastrophe. The country was on a lifeline, and we just cut the line, quoting an evacuated aid worker in the New York Times magazine. The World Food Program, the UN program, did, which is the main one by far, they were able to resume after three weeks in early October. They began to resume at a lower level, resume food shipments. They can't. They don't have international aid workers within, so the distribution system's hampered. That was suspended as soon as the bombing began. They then resumed, but at a lower pace, while aid agencies leveled scathing condemnations of U.S. airdrops, condemning them as propaganda tools, which are probably doing more harm than good. And that happens to be quoting from the London Financial Times, but it's easy to continue. After the first week of bombing, the New York Times reported in a back page inside a column on something else that by the arithmetic of the United Nations, there will soon be 7.5 million Afghans in acute need of even a loaf of bread. And there are only a few weeks left before the harsh winter will make deliveries to many areas totally impossible. Continuing to quote, but with bombs falling, the delivery rate is down to what one half of what is needed. Casual comment, which tells us that Western civilization is anticipating the slaughter of, well, do the arithmetic, 3 to 4 million people, something like that. On the same day, the leader of Western civilization, dismissed with contempt once again, offers of negotiation for delivery of the alleged target, Osama bin Laden, and a request for some evidence to substantiate the demand for total capitulation was dismissed. On the same day, the special rapporteur of the United Nations in charge of food pleaded with the United States to stop the bombing to try to save millions of victims. As far as I'm aware, that was unreported. It was Monday. Yesterday, the major aid agencies, Oxfam and other Christian Aid and others, joined in that plea. Didn't find a report in the New York Times. There was a line in the Boston Globe hidden in a story about another topic, Kashmir. Well, I could easily go on. But all of that, first of all, indicates to us what's happening. It looks like what's happening is some kind of silent genocide. It also gives a good deal of insight into the elite culture, the culture that we're part of. It indicates that whatever what will happen, we don't know, but plans are being made and programs implemented on the assumption that they may lead to the death of several million people in the next couple of weeks. Very casually, with no comment, no particular thought about it, that's just kind of normal. Here, and in a good part of Europe, not in the rest of the world. In fact, not even in much of Europe. So if you read the Irish press or the press in Scotland, say, that close, reactions are very different. Well, that's what's happening now. What's happening now is very much under our control. We can do a lot to affect what's happening. And that's roughly it. Let's turn to the slightly more abstract questions, forgetting for the moment that we're in the midst of apparently trying to murder 3 or 4 million people, not Taliban, of course, they're victims. Let's go back, turn to the question of the historic event that took place in September 11th. And as I said, I think that's correct. It was a historic event. Not, unfortunately, because of its scale. Unpleasant to think about, but in terms of the scale, it's not that unusual. I did say it's the worst, probably the worst instant human toll of any crime, and that may be true. But there are terrorist crimes with effects a bit more drawn out that are much more extreme, unfortunately. Nevertheless, it's a historic event, because there was a change. The change was the direction in which the guns were pointing. That's new, radically new. So it takes a U.S. history. The last time that the national territory of the United States was under attack, or for that matter, even threatened, was when the British burned down Washington in 1814. There have been many comments. It was common to bring up Pearl Harbor, but that's not a good analogy. The Japanese, whatever you think about it, the Japanese bombed military bases in two U.S. colonies, not the national territory. Colonies which had been taken from their inhabitants in not a very pretty way. This is the national territory that's been attacked on a large scale. You can find a few fringe examples, but this is unique. During these close to 200 years, the United States, expelled or mostly exterminated the indigenous population. It's many million people. Conquered half of Mexico, carried out depredations all over the region, Central America, and sometimes beyond. Conquered Hawaii and the Philippines, killing several hundred thousand Filipinos in the process. Since the Second World War, it's extended its reach around the world in ways I don't have to describe, but it was always killing someone else. The fighting was somewhere else. It was others who were getting slaughtered, not here, not the national territory.
You're listening to Professor Noam Chomsky. He teaches linguistics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, one of the world's leading scholars and critics of U.S. foreign policy. We're going to go back to that speech after our break. And if you'd like to get the full video of his speech given just last week at MIT, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. You can also go to freespeech.org. Stay with us. Coming up in our second hour, we'll be talking about Cipro. We'll also be talking about domestic terrorism when it comes to abortion. You are listening to the War and Peace Report as we broadcast just blocks from the towers, what used to be the towers of the World Trade Center. And now to our brief music break.
They got us doing suicide singing, oh my God. In my mind, they got us living genocide singing, oh my God. In my mind, they got us living suicide singing, oh my God, oh my God.
You are listening to Democracy Now in Exile, the War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio, as we return to Professor Noam Chomsky in a speech he gave last week at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Chomsky's one of the leading critics of U.S. foreign policy.
In the case of Europe, the change is even more dramatic because its history is even more horrendous than ours. We are an offshoot of Europe, basically. For hundreds of years, Europe has been casually slaughtering people all over the world. That's how they conquered the world, not by handing out candy to babies. During this period, Europe did suffer murderous wars, but that was European killers murdering one another. The main sport of Europe for hundreds of years was slaughtering one another. The only reason it came to an end in 1945 was had nothing to do with democracies not making war on each other and other fashionable notions. It had to do with the fact that everyone understood that the next time they play the game, it's going to be the end for the world, because the Europeans, including us, had developed such massive weapons of destruction that that game just has to be over. And it goes back hundreds of years. I mean, in the 17th century, about, you know, probably 40% of the population of Germany was wiped out in one war. But during this whole bloody, murderous period, it was Europeans slaughtering each other and Europeans slaughtering people elsewhere. The Congo didn't attack Belgium. India didn't attack England. You know, Algeria didn't attack France. It's uniform. And there are, again, small exceptions, but pretty small in scale, certainly invisible on the scale of what Europe and us were doing to the rest of the world. This is the first change, the first time that the guns have been pointed the other way. In my opinion, that's probably why you see such different reactions on the two sides of the Irish Sea, which I've noticed, incidentally, in many interviews on both sides, national radio on both sides. The world looks very different depending whether you're holding the lash or whether you're being whipped by it for hundreds of years. Very different. So I think the shock and surprise in Europe and its offshoots like here is very understandable. It is a historic event, but regrettably not in scale, in something else. And a reason why the rest of the world, most of the rest of the world, looks at it quite differently. Not that lacking sympathy for the victims of the atrocity or being horrified by them, that's almost uniform, but viewing it from a different perspective, something we might want to understand. Well, let's go to the third question. What is the war against terrorism? And side question, what's terrorism? The war against terrorism has been described in high places as a struggle against a plague, a cancer, which is spread by barbarians, by depraved opponents of civilization itself. That's a feeling that I share. The words I'm quoting, however, happen to be from 20 years ago. That's President Reagan and his Secretary of State. The Reagan administration came into office 20 years ago, declaring that the war against international terrorism would be the core of our foreign policy, describing it in terms of the kind I just mentioned and others. And it was the core of our foreign policy. The Reagan administration responded to this plague spread by depraved opponents of civilization itself by creating an extraordinary international terrorist network, totally unprecedented in scale, which carried out massive atrocities all over the world, primarily, well, partly nearby, but not only there. I won't run through the record. You're all educated people, so I'm sure you learned about it in high school. But I'll just mention one case, which is totally uncontroversial, so we don't need to argue about it. By no means the most extreme, but uncontroversial. It's uncontroversial because of the judgments of the highest international authorities, the International Court of Justice, the World Court, and the UN Security Council. So this one is uncontroversial, at least among people who have some minimal concern for international law, human rights, justice, and other things like that. And now I'll leave you an exercise. You can estimate the size of that category by simply asking how often this uncontroversial case has been mentioned in the commentary of the last month. And it's a particularly relevant one, not only because it's uncontroversial, but because it does offer a precedent as to how a law-abiding state did respond, in fact, to a case of international terrorism, which is uncontroversial, and was even more extreme than the events of September 11th. I'm talking about the Reagan-U.S. war against Nicaragua, which left tens of thousands of people dead, the country ruined, perhaps beyond recovery. Nicaragua did respond. They didn't respond by setting off bombs in Washington. They responded by taking it to the World Court, presenting a case. They had no problem putting together evidence. The World Court accepted their case, ruled in their favor, ordered the condemned what it called the unlawful use of force, which is another word for international terrorism, by the United States, ordered the United States to terminate the crime and to pay massive reparations. The United States, of course, dismissed the court judgment with total contempt and announced that it would not accept the jurisdiction of the court henceforth. Nicaragua then went to the UN Security Council, which considered a resolution calling on all states to observe international law. No one was mentioned, but everyone understood. The United States vetoed the resolution. It now stands as the only state on record which has both been condemned by the World Court for international terrorism and has vetoed the Security Council resolution calling on states to observe international law. Nicaragua then went to the General Assembly, where there's technically no veto, but a negative U.S. vote amounts to a veto. It passed a similar resolution with only the United States, Israel, and El Salvador opposed. The following year, again, this time the United States could only rally Israel to the cause, so two votes opposed to observing international law. At that point, Nicaragua couldn't do anything lawful. They'd tried all the measures. They don't work in a world that is ruled by force. This case, I must say, is uncontroversial, but it's by no means the most extreme. It's also very, we gain a lot of insight into our own culture and society and what's happening now by asking how much we know about all this and how much we talk about it, how much you learn about it in school, you know, how much it's all over the front pages. And this is only the beginning. The United States responded to the World Court and the Security Council by immediately escalating the war very quickly. That was a bipartisan decision, incidentally. The terms of the war were also changed. For the first time, there were official orders given to the terrorist army to attack what are called soft targets, meaning undefended civilian targets, and to keep away from the Nicaraguan army. They were able to do that because the United States had total control of the air over Nicaragua and was able to the mercenary army was supplied with advanced communication equipment. It wasn't a guerrilla army in the normal sense, and could get instructions about the disposition of Nicaraguan army forces so they could attack agricultural collectives, health clinics, and so on, soft targets with impunity. Those were the official orders. Now, what was the reaction? It was known, and there was a reaction to it. The policy was regarded as sensible by left liberal opinion. So Michael Kinsley, who represents the left in mainstream discussion, wrote an article in which he said that we shouldn't be too quick to criticize this policy, as Human Rights Watch had just done. He said, a sensible policy must meet the test of cost-benefit analysis. That is, and I'm quoting now, an analysis of the amount of blood and misery that will be poured in and the likelihood that democracy will emerge at the other end. Democracy, as the U.S. Understands the term, which is graphically illustrated in the surrounding countries. Notice that it's axiomatic that the United States, U.S. elites have the right to conduct the analysis and to pursue the project if it passes their tests. And it did pass their tests. It worked. When Nicaragua finally succumbed to superpower assault, commentators openly and cheerfully lauded the success of the methods that were adopted and described them accurately. So I'll quote Time magazine, just to pick one, lauded the success of the methods adopted to wreck the economy and prosecute a long and deadly proxy war until the exhausted natives overthrow the unwanted government themselves with a cost to us that is minimal, leaving the victims with wrecked bridges, sabotaged power stations, and ruined farms, and thus providing the U.S. candidate with a winning issue, ending the impoverishment of the people of Nicaragua. The New York Times had a headline saying, "Americans united in joy at this outcome." That's the culture in which we live, and it reveals several facts. One is the fact that terrorism works. It doesn't fail. It works. Violence usually works. That's world history. Secondly, it's a very serious analytic error to say, as is commonly done, that terrorism is a weapon of the weak. Like other means of violence, it's primarily a weapon of the strong, overwhelmingly, in fact. It is held to be a weapon of the weak because the strong also control the doctrinal systems, and their terror doesn't count as terror. That's close to universal. I can't think of an exception, historical exception. Even the worst mass murderers viewed the world that way. So take the Nazis. They weren't carrying out terror in occupied Europe. They were protecting the population from the terrorism of the partisans. And like other resistance movements, there was terrorism. The Nazis were carrying out counter-terror. Furthermore, the United States essentially agreed with that. After the war, the U.S. Army did extensive studies of Nazi counter-terror operations in Europe. First, I should say that the U.S. picked them up and began carrying them out itself, often against the same targets. The former resistance. But the army, the military also studied the Nazi methods, published interesting studies, sometimes critical of them because they were inefficiently carried out. So there's a critical analysis of, you know, they didn't do this right, didn't do that right. But those methods, with the advice of Wehrmacht officers who were brought over here, became the manuals of counterinsurgency, of counterterror, of low-intensity conflict, as it's called, and are the manuals and are the procedures that are being used. So it's not just that the Nazis did it, it's that it was regarded as the right thing to do by the leaders of Western civilization, that is us, who then proceeded to do it themselves. Terrorism is not the weapon of the weak. It is the weapon of those who are against us, whoever us happens to be. And if you can find a historical exception to that, I'd be interested in seeing it. An interesting indication of the nature of our culture, our high culture, is the way in which all of this is regarded. One way it's regarded is just suppressing it, so almost nobody's ever heard of it. And the power of American propaganda and doctrine is so strong that even among the victims it's barely known. I mean, when you talk to this about this to, you know, people in Argentina, you have to remind them before they say, "Oh yeah, that happened. We forgot about it." It's deeply suppressed. The sheer consequences of monopoly of violence can be very powerful in ideological and other terms. One illuminating aspect of our own attitude toward terrorism, ours, is the reaction to the idea that Nicaragua might have the right to defend itself. Actually, I went through this in some detail with, you know, database searches and that sort of thing. The idea that Nicaragua might have the right to defend itself was considered outrageous. There is virtually nothing in mainstream commentary indicating that Nicaragua might have that right. And that fact was exploited by the Reagan administration and its propaganda in an interesting way. Those of you who are around at that time will remember that they periodically floated rumors that the Nicaraguans were getting MiG jets from Russia. At that point, the hawks and the doves split. The hawks said, "Okay, let's bomb them." The dove said, "Wait a minute, let's see if the rumors are true. And if the rumors are true, then let's bomb them." Because they're a threat to the United States. Why, incidentally, were they getting MiGs? Well, because the United States, they try to get jet planes from European countries, but the United States put pressure on its allies so they wouldn't send them means of defense because they wanted them to turn to the Russians. That's good for propaganda purposes. Then they become a threat to us. Right? You remember they were just two days march from Harlingen, Texas. We actually declared a national emergency in 1985 to protect the country from the threat of Nicaragua. And it stayed in force. But so it was much better for them to get arms from the Russians. Well, why would they want jet planes? Well, for the reasons that I already mentioned. The United States had total control of their airspace, was overflying it, and using that to provide instructions to the terrorist army to enable them to attack soft targets without running into the army that might defend them. So therefore, and everyone knew that that was the reason, you know, they're not going to use their jet planes for anything else. But the idea that Nicaragua should be permitted to defend its airspace against a superpower attack that is directing terrorist forces to attack undefended civilian targets, that was considered in the United States outrageous and uniformly so. Exceptions are so slight, you know, I can practically list them. I don't suggest that you take my word for this. Have a look. Includes our own senators, incidentally. Another illustration of how we regard terrorism is happening right now. The U.S. has just appointed an ambassador to the United Nations to lead the war against terrorism a couple of weeks ago. Who is he? Well, his name's John Negroponte. He was the U.S. ambassador in the fiefdom, which is what it is, of Honduras in the early 1980s. There was a little fuss made about the fact that he must have been aware, as he certainly was, of the large-scale murders and other atrocities that were being carried out by the security forces in Honduras that we were supporting. But that's a small part of it. As proconsul of Honduras, as he was called there, he was the local supervisor for the terrorist war based in Honduras, for which his government was condemned by the World Court, and then the Security Council in a vetoed resolution. And he was just appointed as a UN ambassador to lead the war against terror. Another small experiment you can do is check and see what the reaction was to this. Well, tell you what you're going to find, but find it for yourself. That tells us a lot about the war against terrorism and about ourselves.
Professor Noam Chomsky teaches linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, longtime critic of U.S. foreign policy, giving a major anti-war address last week at MIT. And we'll continue this speech after the break. If you'd like to order a video cassette of the full Chomsky speech, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. You can also order it by going to the website www.freespeech.org. Back in a minute.
Destruction of the poor is in the poverty. Destruction of the soul is vanity, yeah. So stiff-necked fools, you think you are good to deny me for simplicity. Yeah, yes, you are gone for so.
You are listening to the War and Peace Report. This is Free Speech Radio as we break the sound barrier. Democracy Now in Exile, continuing with the speech of Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, giving a major anti-war address last week at his university.
After the United States took over the country again under the conditions that were so graphically described by the press, the country is pretty much destroyed in the 1980s, but it's totally collapsed since in every respect, just about economically. It's declined sharply since the U.S. takeover, democratically in every other respect. It's now the second poorest country in the hemisphere. I'm not going to talk about it, but I mentioned that I picked up Nicaragua because it's an uncontroversial case. If you look at the other states in the region, the state terror was far more extreme. And it again traces back to Washington, and that's by no means all. It was happening elsewhere in the world, too. So take, say, Africa. During the Reagan years alone, South African attacks backed by the United States and Britain, South African, U.S., U.K.-backed South African attacks against the neighboring countries, killed about 1.5 million people and left $60 billion of damage and countries destroyed. And if we go around the world, we can add more examples. Now, that was the war, the first war against terror, of which I've given a small sample. Are we supposed to pay attention to that or kind of think that that might be relevant? After all, it's not exactly ancient history. Well, evidently not, as you can tell by looking at the current discussion of the war on terror, which has been the leading topic for the last month. I mentioned that Nicaragua has now become the second poorest country in the hemisphere. What's the first, the poorest country? Well, that's, of course, Haiti, which also happens to be the victim of most U.S. intervention in the 20th century by a long shot, which has left it totally devastated. It's the poorest country. Nicaragua is second ranked in degree of U.S. intervention in the 22nd century. It's the second poorest. Actually, it's vying with Guatemala. They interchange every year or two as to who's the second poorest, and they also vie as to which is the leading target of U.S. military intervention. We're supposed to think that all of this is some sort of accident, you know, has nothing to do with anything that happened in history, maybe. The worst human rights violator in the 1990s is Colombia, by a long shot. It's also by far the leading recipient of U.S. military aid in the 1990s, maintaining the terror and human rights violation. In 1999, Colombia replaced Turkey as the leading recipient of U.S. arms worldwide. That's excluding Israel and Egypt, which are a separate category. And that tells us a lot more about the war on terror right now, in fact. Why was Turkey getting such a huge flow of U.S. arms? Well, if you take a look at the flow of U.S. arms to Turkey, Turkey always got a lot of U.S. arms. It's strategically placed, a member of NATO, and so on. But the arms flow to Turkey went up very sharply in 1984. That didn't have anything to do with the Cold War. I mean, Russia was collapsing. And it stayed high from 1984 until 1999 when it reduced and it was replaced in the lead by Colombia. What happened from 1984 to 1999? Well, in 1984, Colombia launched a major terrorist war against the Kurds in southeastern Turkey. And that's when U.S. aid went up, military aid. And this was not pistols. This is jet planes, tanks, military training, and so on. And it stayed high as the atrocities escalated through the 1990s. Aid followed it. The peak year was 1997. In 1997, U.S. aid, the military aid to Turkey was more than in the entire period, 1950 to 1983, that is the Cold War period, which is an indication of how much the Cold War has affected policy. The results were awesome. This led to 2 to 3 million refugees, some of the worst ethnic cleansing of the late 1990s, tens of thousands of people killed, 3,500 towns and villages destroyed, way more than Kosovo, even under NATO bombs. And the United States is providing 80% of the arms, increasing as the atrocities increased, peaking in 1997. It declined in 1999 because once again terror worked, as it usually does, when carried out by its major agents, namely the powerful. So by 1999, Turkish terror, called, of course, counter-terror, but as I said, that's universal, it worked. Therefore, Turkey was replaced by Colombia, which had not yet succeeded in its terrorist war, and therefore had to move into first place as recipient of U.S. arms. Well, what makes this all particularly striking is that all of this was taking place right in the midst of a huge flood of self-congratulation on the part of Western intellectuals, which probably has no counterpart in history. I mean, you all remember it. It was just a couple of years ago. Massive self-adulation about how, for the first time in history, we are so magnificent that we're standing up for principles and values and dedicated to ending inhumanity everywhere and the new era of this and that and so on and so forth. And we certainly can't tolerate atrocities right near the borders of NATO. That was repeated over and over. Only within the borders of NATO, where we can not only tolerate much worse atrocities, but contribute to them. Well, another insight into Western civilization and our own is how often this was brought up. Try to look. I won't repeat it, but it's instructive. It's a pretty impressive feat for a propaganda system to carry this off in a free society. That's pretty amazing. I don't think you could do this in a totalitarian state. And Turkey is very grateful. Just a few days ago, the Prime Minister, Ecevit, announced that Turkey would join the coalition against terror very enthusiastically, even more so than others. In fact, he said it would contribute troops, which others have not been willing to do. And he explained why. He said, we owe a debt of gratitude to the United States because the United States was the only country that was willing to contribute so massively to our own, in his words, counter-terrorist war, that is to our own massive ethnic cleansing and atrocities and terror. No other countries kind of, you know, they helped a little, but they stayed back. The United States, on the other hand, contributed enthusiastically and decisively and was able to do so because of the silence, servility might be the right word, of the educated classes who could easily find out about it. You know, it's a free country, after all. You can read human rights reports. You can read all sorts of stuff. But chose to contribute to the atrocities, and Turkey is very happy to. They owe us a debt of gratitude for that, and therefore will contribute troops, just as during the war in Serbia, Turkey was very much praised for using its F-16s, which we supplied it, to bomb Serbia, exactly as it had been doing with the same planes against its own population up until the time when it finally succeeded in crushing internal terror, as they called it. And as usual, as always, resistance does include terror. It's true of the American Revolution. In fact, it's true of every case I know. Just as it's true that those who have a monopoly of violence talk about themselves as carrying out counter-terror. Well, that's pretty impressive. And that has to do with the coalition against that is now being organized to fight the war against terror. And it's very interesting to see how that coalition is being described. So have a look at this morning's Christian Science Monitor. That's a good newspaper, one of the best international newspapers with real coverage of the world. The lead story, the front page story, is about how the United States, you know, people used to dislike the United States, but now they're beginning to respect it. And they're very happy about the way the U.S. is leading the war against terror. And the prime example, in fact, the only serious example, the others are a joke, is Algeria. It turns out that Algeria is very enthusiastic about the U.S. war against terror. The person who wrote the article is an expert on Africa. He must know that Algeria is one of the most vicious terrorist states in the world. has been carrying out horrendous terror against its own population in past couple of years, in fact. For a while, this was under wraps, but it was finally exposed in France with defectors from the Algerian army, and so all over the place there, and in England and so on. But here, we're very proud because one of the worst terror states in the world is now enthusiastically welcoming the U.S. war on terror, and in fact is cheering on the United States to lead the war. That shows how popular we're getting. And if you look at the coalition that's being formed against terror, it tells you a lot more. A leading member of the coalition is Russia, which is delighted to have the United States support its murderous terrorist war in Chechnya instead of occasionally criticizing it in the background. China's joining enthusiastically. It's delighted to have support for the atrocities it's carrying out in Western China against what it calls Muslim secessionists. Turkey, as I mentioned, is very happy with the war against terror. They're experts in it. Algeria, Indonesia, delighted to have even more U.S. support for atrocities that it's carrying out in Aceh and elsewhere. Now, we can run through the list. The list of the states that have joined the coalition against terror is quite impressive. They have a characteristic in common. They are among the leading terror states in the world, and they happen to be led by the world champion. Well, that brings us back to the question, what is terrorism? I've been assuming we understand it, but what is it? Well, there happen to be some easy answers to this. There is an official definition. You can find it in the U.S. Code or in U.S. Army manuals. A brief statement of it taken from a U.S. Army manual is fair enough, is that terror is the calculated use of violence or the threat of violence to attain political or religious ideological goals through intimidation, coercion, or instilling fear. That's terrorism. That's a fair enough definition. I think it's reasonable to accept that. The problem is it can't be accepted, because if you accept that, all the wrong consequences follow. For example, the consequences I've just been reviewing. Now, there is a major effort right now at the UN to try to develop a comprehensive treaty on terrorism. When Kofi Annan got the Nobel Prize the other day, you'll notice he was reported as saying we should stop wasting time on this and really get down to it. But there's a problem. If you use the official definition of terrorism in the comprehensive treaty, you're going to get completely the wrong results. So that can't be done. In fact, it's even worse than that. If you take a look at the definition of low-intensity warfare, which is official U.S. policy, you find that it's a very close paraphrase of what I just read. In fact, low-intensity conflict is just another name for terrorism.
Professor Noam Chomsky teaches linguistics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he gave this major anti-war address last week. We're going to play the rest of this speech tomorrow on the War and Peace Report. Noam Chomsky, one of the world's leading scholars and critics of U.S. foreign policy. If you'd like to order a video cassette copy of the full Noam Chomsky speech, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. Or you can go to the website, www.freespeech.org. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our technical director. Errol Maitland's at the helm at WBIX.org, where you can hear Democracy Now! You can also hear us at democracynow.org and webactive.org. Thanks to Amy Pomerleau at KPFA and Aaron Glantz of Free Speech Radio News. Thanks to everyone at KPFA and affiliate station KFCF in Fresno. All the affiliate stations around the country, we are Pacifica. And to the Downtown Community Television folks, John Alpert and Keiko Suno, thank you for being our hosts. I am in exile. The whole staff from WBAI, from the embattled studios there, from the studios of the Band in the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Thank you. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
Abortionists are murderers. Murderers should be executed.
I definitely felt that the Lord wanted me to shoot the abortionist.
We need a civil war that will kill a whole lot of people.
Domestic terror. Today, a look at the Army of God.
The Army of God is an amorphous, evanescent, autonomous eruption of rage in their defense of the unborn children.
I hate to quote Chairman Mao, but he was right. Kill one, scare a thousand.
Today, we'll look also at Cipro, the battle over Bayer. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Two D.C. postal workers, Joseph Kersine and Thomas Morris, have died of what appears to be anthrax after reporting to emergency rooms only hours earlier. Two others have also contracted inhalational anthrax, and nine other people are suffering from anthrax-like symptoms and are awaiting results. Local postal union leaders said the two deaths might have been prevented if officials had respected workers' requests for earlier testing and antibiotic distribution. The Pentagon has approved a project to make a more potent form of the deadly anthrax bacteria. The project run by the Defense Intelligence Agency was delayed for weeks as Pentagon lawyers debated whether the research violated the 1972 Germ Treaty banning biological weapons that the United States helped champion. The U.S. walked away from a discussion of international protocol on bioweapons this summer under pressure from drug companies who didn't want to open up their operations to inspection. The Pentagon claims it's developing the deadly form of anthrax in order to see if the vaccine the U.S. intends to supply its armed forces is effective against it. Administration officials have declined to discuss the details of the project. Meanwhile, the U.S. has signed an agreement with Uzbekistan to remove deadly anthrax from a remote island in the Aral Sea, where the Soviet Union dumped tons of lethal spores. They said the agreement reflected growing concern that terrorists or states might seek to obtain anthrax, which the Soviet Union secretly buried on the island in 1988. And after years of complaints by U.S. officials that security measures are too lax, the world's largest organization of scientific germ banks said yesterday that it is stepping up security. The World Federation for Culture Collections, a union of nearly 500 germ banks in 61 countries, said it's removing information about anthrax from its internet sites and is pushing for tighter distribution rules among its members. Germ banks are scientific supply houses that provide cell cultures and microorganisms to researchers, either free, for sale, or in exchange for other organisms. And some U.S. establishments have begun destroying their own stocks of microbes. The Northern Alliance asked the U.S. to hit Taliban front lines harder as U.S. bombers attacked Afghan cities and the front lines again today. This despite witness reports that a Taliban rocket slammed into the main bazaar in the opposition-held town of Charikar near the front line, killing two people, including a 60-year-old vegetable vendor. And the British newspaper The Independent is reporting that the first U.S. air raids on the Taliban front line north of Kabul missed their targets entirely and drop bombs close to their anti-Taliban allies. The Taliban front line is difficult to identify from the air and winds its way through heavily populated villages, orchards, and vineyards. Pakistan's military ruler, General Pervez Musharraf, last night warned the U.S. to stop its military campaign in Afghanistan before the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan in November. In an interview on Larry King Live, Musharraf warned that continued U.S. attacks during Ramadan could trigger considerable sympathy for the Taliban across the Muslim world. Meanwhile, police in Pakistan yesterday arrested several hundred members of the largest Islamic party to stop a protest planned in a remote town with an airbase now being used by U.S. troops. Russia has struck a multi-million dollar arms deal with the Northern Alliance. Under the agreement, the alliance is already receiving tanks, helicopters, and anti-aircraft missiles. Israeli troops occupied nearly all the main towns of the West Bank last night after the widest incursion into Palestinian-controlled areas of the occupied territories since the start of the year-long conflict. Soldiers killed another 8 Palestinians and injured dozens. The dead included a woman who, according to Palestinian officials, was hit by tank shell fragments in Beit Jala, and a 15-year-old boy shot dead east of the town. Meanwhile, Israeli forces arrested at least a dozen Palestinians and assassinated a senior Hamas member. Following the assassination of Israel's right-wing tourism minister, Israeli forces swept into 6 major Palestinian towns last week with tanks and troops, sparking gun battles on the streets, which have left at least 26 Palestinians dead and several Israeli soldiers injured. Yesterday, 800 protesters blockaded the main entrance to the Clyde Trident submarine base in Faslane, Britain. The base is home to Britain's 4-strong Trident nuclear submarine fleet and the nuclear-powered hunter-killer submarines, some of which are already operating in Afghanistan, in the area of Afghanistan. One protester said the people being bombed are just the same as the people bombed in the Twin Towers. They're innocent civilians, and this kind of random slaughter is only going to fuel extremism. Police arrested more than 150 people. Stop the War, Edwin Starr, here on the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood and where the fire still burns. In the second half of today's program, we're going to take a look at domestic terror. We'll look at the Army of God.
For Supreme Court judges to be killed, and also for chemical and biological weapons, and we support this call.
But first, we're going to take a look at Cipro and the battle over Bayer. In Washington, D.C. yesterday, 2 postal workers died of what officials say was inhalation anthrax, and 2 more workers were hospitalized. Health officials are monitoring 9 others with suspicious symptoms who worked at the D.C. postal facility, which serves the Capitol. Today, we're going to look at the pharmaceutical giant Bayer, the maker of Cipro. This is a piece on the front page of the Wall Street Journal yesterday. It says, workers at Bayer AG's U.S. unit let out a cheer last Monday as they watched NBC anchor Tom Brokaw hold up a bottle of pills during his nightly newscast, peer into the camera, and say, "In Cipro, we trust." But the next day, New York Senator Charles Schumer questioned whether Bayer could meet soaring demand for the potent anthrax antibiotic and called for government action to allow generic production. "I couldn't believe it," says Frank Morich, the head of Bayer's global health business. All of a sudden, it was in Cipro we trust, but not in Bayer. Well, Bayer has a long controversial history, beginning with its roots in the German company IG Farben, which worked hand in hand with the Nazis. It's been sued by Holocaust survivors for its role in forced labor and medical experiments and other crimes. It's been sued by people with hemophilia who contracted AIDS through tainted blood transfusions. And it has been targeted by AIDS activists around the world for fighting against cheap AIDS drugs for poorer countries. Cipro, the antibiotic that many say can help treat anthrax, is 10 times as expensive as generic equivalents. That's what made New York Senator Charles Schumer call for the Bush administration to break Bayer's patent and produce generic equivalents of the drug. The Bayer-Cipro controversy is a microcosm of the global conflict between public health and private profit, between the needs of poor countries for cheap medicines and the desire of rich corporations to preserve their patents. It's a conflict that will come to a head in a little over a week when the WTO holds a major ministerial meeting in Qatar, where poor countries will press the U.S. to relax drug patents on life-saving medicines. Today, we're going to take a look at the controversial company with three people from around the world who have been dealing with Bayer for quite a long time. We're going to begin with Sharon Ann Lynch with Health Gap Global Access Project and ACT UP New York. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Talk about Bayer.
Well, one, as you mentioned, Bayer has a long history of price gouging and of ruthless profiteering in the midst of human disaster. The tainted blood product, certainly an example. Also, they were a primary plaintiff in the lawsuit of drug company consortiums against South Africa regarding AIDS and other essential drugs. They also are under investigation by the Federal Trade Commission for ostensibly giving millions of dollars of money to another drug producer for keeping Cipro from market in the U.S., after the patent expires in 2003. Basically, Bayer is more than happy to collude with U.S. government and with even with anthrax hysteria growing to prevent the low-cost generic Cipro from coming to the U.S.
Well, let's step back for a minute and take a look at where Bayer comes from, or Bayer, as it's known in Germany. We go now to Germany to Philipp Mimkes, who is with the Coalition Against Bayer Dangers, known as CBG. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Yeah, good morning to New York.
Hi. Can you start off by giving us a history of Bayer?
Well, actually, Bayer is even older than what you told us some minutes ago. The history goes back to the 1860s when it started as a small company in Wuppertal, close to Cologne. A small company making dyes, but already in the end of the 19th century, Bayer was a global player with tens of thousands of people working for them and producing dyes, stuffs, and pharmaceuticals for all over the world. And it started becoming really a global player when in the 1920s and 1925, Bayer merged with Hoechst and BASF and all the small German chemical companies to form IG Farben, which, as you said, became famous or infamous for their close ties during the Third Reich to the Nazi government. So we are opposing a company with a long tradition and a company with a broad range of problems they are causing. Bayer is number two pesticide producer in the world. As you know, the World Health Organization is calculating about 20 million people getting sick by pesticides each year. Bayer is strong in genetic engineering. Bayer is producing a lot of products that are quite dangerous for all of us.
I'm looking at an article in the Times Herald Record from in Terre Haute, Indiana, 1999, and it says, the German pharmaceutical giant Bayer participated in World War II atrocities committed by Nazi doctors who experimented on Jews, according to a suit filed by a Holocaust survivor. Eva Moses Kaur of Terre Haute filed the lawsuit in U.S. District Court with her sister. Ms. Kaur was among the hundreds of sets of twins experimented on by the infamous Dr. Joseph Mengele at the Auschwitz concentration camp. Bayer paid Nazi officials for access to those confined in concentration camps and collaborated in Nazi experiments as a form of research and development, according to the plaintiff's lawyer. How did Bayer ultimately resolve its involvement with the Nazis?
Well, the ties were very, very close. There were ties into the government, and Bayer was actually part of the coalition that built up Auschwitz. Bayer or IG Farben built their own plant in Auschwitz, which was run and built by prisoners, and at least 300,000 slave workers worked for IG Farben during the Second World War, and at least 30,000 of these slave workers did not survive the slave labor working conditions in Auschwitz. And that's one part of their crimes. The other crimes, part of their crimes, as you said, were the medical experiments. And we cooperated with Eva Kohr and we cooperated with a lawyer from New York to put pressure on Bayer. And actually, Bayer last year had to participate after we've been working on this issue for 20 years, but during the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, nobody really was interested in looking on the history of German companies in the Third Reich. This only changed when American lawyers put on pressure on the companies, and this resulted in the fund that was started this year, a 10 billion German Mark fund, half paid by the German government, half paid by German companies to give compensation for former slave workers. But of course, we have to remind that about 80 to 90% of these surviving slave workers no more live today.
So the Bayer Corporation must be rather sensitive about its image, if nothing else, at this point, and dealing with people who could die as a result of, now perhaps not being able to get Cipro. I wanted to turn to Jamie Love, who is with the Consumer Project on Technology in Washington, D.C. In the last few weeks, the Canadian government announced that it was going to break the Bayer patent on Cipro and produce it much more cheaply, generically. It's backed off this, though. Can you talk about what happened?
Well, I think in the Canadian case, they have a statute, like most countries do, like the United States does, which allows the government to step in and use a patent if they need to for pretty much any purpose they want. In the Canadian case, there was a requirement that they obtain a license from the patent commissioner, and the health department didn't do that in Canada. So I think what they've done is they've gone back and they're going to revisit the issue, and they're going to go through their procedures again. I think that it was a good thing that they decided that the decision to act was, was under the circumstances. I think it was understandable that they wanted to move fast, and that's what they did. In contrast, in the United States, the U.S. government doesn't have to obtain licenses to use patents. We have the easiest use provision that you can imagine. Any government employee can give any private third-party contractor or private corporation or whatever the right to use a patent to do any government purpose they want, and it's the patent owner has no right to sue the government or the private party over the decision over whether or not to use the patent. The area where you have litigation in the United States, as you would in Canada, is on the compensation of how much the patent owner gets paid for the government use of the patent.
And ultimately, why did this all get changed, flipped around?
Well, in the case of Canada, I think that the opposition party was roughing up the government a bit. I think that the issue is not really resolved right now. In the United States, the government wants to have antibiotics for 12 million people, and they have for about 2 million right now, I was reading. So they have to add, initially they were talking about using ciprofloxacin as the medicine, and that would be about 1.2 billion pills. I think Bayer was manufacturing around 15 million a week. So it would just take them for a really, really long time to meet the stockpile requirements.
Speaking of patents, the FTC investigation of the agreement between Bayer and another company, Bar Labs, to keep generic Cipro off the U.S. market?
Bayer, like a lot of the companies, has been engaged in a lot of anti-competitive practices to stop competition. In the case of the patent on ciprofloxacin in the United States, Bayer had pretty much discovered, you know, what it took would have taken to break the patent, and so, or just to bust the patent in the United States. That is to say, to prove that the invention was not patentable, and that that there was prior art or something like that. So, rather than allow competition, Bayer was willing to pay a couple hundred million dollars actually to Bar not to produce the drug. So it became a really big source of profit for Bar, even they weren't manufacturing anything. And I think it's pretty easy to see that if you're paying somebody hundreds of millions of dollars not to compete with you, that would seem like an antitrust violation. There's in fact some class action lawsuits right now against Bayer, with potentially huge damages against Bayer for that practice on this drug.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we're going to talk about Bayer and AIDS, South Africa, and Qatar, the meeting that's coming up of the World Trade Organization, and how Bayer fits in. You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile, the War and Peace Report. Our guest, Jamie Love, Consumer Project on Technology, and Philip Mimkis, Coalition Against Bayer Dangers in Germany. Sharon Ann Lynch in the studio with us from HealthGap. Stay with us.
Yeah. Ooh. Oh, you may be an ambassador to England or France. You might like to gamble. You might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you're gonna serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
I want you to know you're gonna serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
It might be the devil, it might be the Lord,
but you're gonna serve somebody.
Woo! Oh, yeah.
You're listening to the War and Peace Report as we break the sound barrier here on Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman talking about Bayer and Cipro. Though it's interesting, I have to say, in today's daily news, there's a piece that says Cipro, the antibiotic thousands of postal workers are taking to ward off anthrax, is powerful, but there's no medical proof it'll prevent the disease. Dr. Stephen Baum at Beth Israel Medical Center said it has the best chance of working, but there have been no clinical trials. He said the drug has been effective on lab animals with the disease, but no one has tested Cipro against inhalation anthrax in humans. We're talking, though, about Bayer Corporation and its history and also its practices today. Sharon Ann Lynch with HealthGap Global Access Project and ACT UP New York. It was just the news broke this morning about Canada backing off its threat to break the Bayer patent and produce Cipro itself much more cheaply. Why did this happen?
Basically, Canada and U.S. have been blocking poor countries' initiatives coming up to WTO in Qatar in November that would clarify the patent rules that apply to essential drugs and AIDS drugs. Basically, they would be incredibly embarrassed if they used a tool known as compulsory license, generic production, when they've been saying this is not a useful tool, that it doesn't matter that 95% of the 36 million people with HIV and AIDS do not have access to drugs. Therefore, it shows the complicity with pharma and the extent that they'll go through.
Pharma is?
The pharmaceutical company of there's an association in the U.S. and international. So it shows the complicity with the drug industry in order to uphold the patent system, no matter the cost. Anthrax hysteria or millions of deaths due to AIDS.
Can you talk about this meeting in Qatar in the World Trade Organization and what that has to do with Bayer?
Over 50 poor countries have been working on a declaration that they would like to see ratified at the World Trade Organization meeting in Qatar in November. This would clarify the rules on patents. So far, there are a number of countries that have to recognize a 20-year patent system. Patents basically allow a drug monopoly, giving a drug company the ability to price a drug at whatever price they want to. A number of safeguards are legal within the WTO patent rules. However, without clarification or without revision of those patent rules, access will continue to be denied to millions of people with HIV, AIDS, and other diseases.
Jamie Love of the Consumer Project on Technology. It seems that the president and the Bush administration are working very hard and fast as they prosecute this war on Afghanistan to pass as much legislation on many different issues under the rubric of the war on terrorism, from drilling in the Arctic to fast-track legislation. But something that may have backfired is what's going on right now with Cipro, because it's people calling for cheaper drugs, cheaper access or free access to Cipro produced by Bayer. Do you think that the U.S. has successfully squelched that discussion?
No, I don't. And I think if you look over the past year, there's been several different things that have brought this issue of compulsory licensing to the forefront in the public mind. One was on the stem cell transplants. And when they announced the limited number of stem cell lines they were going to make available for research, one of the big complaints was there was too many patents on the stem cell lines that they released. And the idea was that if there was too many patents on a stem cell, it wouldn't be that useful. Well, that was kind of the story, that sometimes patents are a barrier to the development of a product, not something that enables the development of a product. And that's because the people that hold the patents are too aggressive, particularly the biotech companies, in terms of the licensing terms they want. Then you have the Bayer case, where Bayer plainly cannot produce on a timely basis the amount of the drug that the U.S. says it needs for the stockpile. And so Thompson's willing to put people's, as Sharon so eloquently put it, lives at risk just in order to deny Africans, if they can, the opportunity to do the same thing in Africa. And then you have I think, a lot of growing disputes over diagnostic patents on the breast cancer screening gene, which is now not available to a lot of Americans because of the existence of a government-funded patent, which is used by a Utah company, Myriad Technologies. It's priced above what a lot of insurance companies will pay. So as more and more of these stories pop up, I think there's going to be more and more pressure to look at what Sherrod Brown has got. Sherrod Brown's got this bill, H.R. 1708, which would give the United States the same kind of authority to issue compulsory licenses on patents that most European countries have.
We're going to end with Philip Mimkus on hemophilia and Bayer. Can you describe that story?
Yeah, Bayer is the world market leader for hemophilia products, and by their American subsidiary Qatar, they infected about 50% of all hemophiliacs that were infected with AIDS. 50% were infected by Bayer's products. So we've been cooperating with the organizations of hemophiliacs who are fighting for compensation for many years. And we've invited several hemophiliacs, even from the United States, to come to Germany, even to speak at a Bayer stockholder meeting to face the Bayer board to talk on their problems. And they received some kind of compensation in the United States, but the situation is very difficult for the victims across the world. Whereas in Japan, where there was strong pressure from the government on Bayer, they paid a high compensation and a lifelong medication for the people. In the United States, they only received a sum of about $100,000 per person, and here in Germany, it's even less. The story was that Bayer had known of the problems for about 2 years, but before they stopped selling the infected drugs, because by that time the danger was not known, and the government did not oppose to this selling of drugs. So Bayer knowingly infected people with HIV and AIDS, but never was fined for that afterwards.
Well, we have to wrap up this discussion, but we'll certainly continue to follow the story. Philip Mimke is speaking to us from Germany in the Coalition Against Bayer Dangers, which cooperates with partners in 46 countries within and outside of many of the Bayer factories around the world. Jamie Love with the Consumer Project on Technology in Washington, that website, www.cptech.org, and Sharon Ann Lynch with HealthGap Global Access Project, your website.
HealthGap.org. Also, there's a global petition demanding fairer patent rules on pharmaceuticals. Please
sign. Where can they get that?
At HealthGap.org.
Well, thank you all very much for being with us as we move into the last segment of today's program, and that is the issue of domestic terror.
Abortionists are murderers. Murderers should be executed.
I definitely felt that the Lord wanted me to shoot the abortionist.
We need a civil war that will kill a whole lot of people.
Investigators say evidence places Rudolph in the bombing. They aren't sure whether others may be involved.
The Army of God is an amorphous, evanescent, autonomous eruption of rage in their defense of the unborn children.
I hate to quote Chairman Mao, but he was right. Kill one, scare a thousand.
Dr. John Britton and clinic volunteer Jim Barrett lay dead. Police arrested Paul Hill a half block away.
You have actually been an Army of God soldier in training.
The next step is to arm ourselves in a militia, a real militia, that has the power to resist the federal government.
A prominent local doctor who performed abortions was gunned down inside his home.
It was the fifth such sniper attack in 4 years.
Anybody who raises a weapon up against these people who are slaughtering these...
An excerpt of the documentary Soldiers in the Army of God. You are listening to the War and Peace Report, and we're joined by Dr. Leroy Carhart, who is a physician who works in Bellevue, Nebraska, and provides abortion. Dr. Carhart took a challenge on Nebraska's ban on so-called partial birth abortions all the way to the Supreme Court, and last June, the court struck down the ban, finding it unconstitutional, a violation of Roe v. Wade, the decision that guaranteed the right to abortion. On October 17th, Carhart, a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel, sent an open letter to President Bush, which begins by thanking the president for his response to the September 11th terrorist attack. Since 1977, seven abortion providers have been murdered. There have been 17 attempted murders of clinic staff, 41 clinic bombings, and 165 arsons. Since abortion became legal in 1973, there have been 2,400 attacks on abortion clinics. Today, we talk about domestic terror, and Dr. Carhart is on the line with us. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you very much, Miranda.
Well, actually, this is Amy. Miranda's the producer, but
sorry.
That's okay. This letter that you wrote to President Bush, where you thank him for his response to the attacks on September 11th against the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, can you read the rest of it?
Oh, surely. Well, the first paragraph, as you started out, that was a direct quote. And then I went on to say, but now I must ask a question. Can you help the nation's abortion providers and their staffs who have been the victims of repeated acts of fringe radical religious terrorists during the past 25 years? They have burnt and bombed our homes and businesses. They have kidnapped and held hostage our members. And without regard to age or sex, they have murdered our unarmed men and women. In the last quarter of a century, over 20% of our buildings have been destroyed by arson and bombs. Terrorists have murdered our policemen and guards as they tried to come to the aid of the innocent victims of their attacks. They have murdered nearly 0.2% of our community in their homes, in front of their children and friends, and at their places of work. And then I went on to say that like the terrorists that struck the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, some mainstream religious groups support our domestic terrorists. While their religious leaders preach salvation, they fund terrorists to commit arson and murder. Like the September 11th terrorists, domestic terrorists live amongst us as sleepers in our communities. They send their children to our schools, they work out in our gyms, and they live a normal life while awaiting their assignments. For over 25 years, abortion providers have gone to work each day fearing intimidation, property damage, personal injury, and even death at the hands of those wishing to force their personal beliefs upon all of us. Despite this terror, many leaders of our state governments continue to grant asylum and immunity from prosecution. In the face of all this, our members have done as you asked all Americans to do, to try to continue our normal lives and not let the terrorists win by causing us to stop our normal activities. The terrorists that pursue us do not respect the laws of our country. They also blaspheme the doctrines of the very religions that they claim to represent, while they carry out their atrocities protected by a blind eye of their religious leaders. Our Constitution and the laws of our land have defined their actions as both unconstitutional and illegal, yet the terror continues. Too often, law enforcement and judicial officials treat them only as a nuisance and do too little to prevent or to stop and prosecute their atrocities. In your speech to Congress and the nation on September 20th, you stated, "We are not deceived by their," and I put the terrorists in parentheses, "pretense to piety. We have seen their kind before. They are the heirs of all the murderous ideologies of the 20th century. By sacrificing human life to serve their radical visions, by abandoning every value except their will to power, they follow in the path of fascism, Nazism, and totalitarianism, and they will follow that path all the way to where it ends, in history's unmarked grave of discarded lives."
That is Dr. Leroy Carhart reading his own letter to President Bush. Did you get a response?
We received, of course, I sent this by email because it was during the really intense part of the anthrax scare, not that I think that's over. So I sent it by email, and we received a response the next day that the White House had received the letter and we would that they would respond to it appropriately.
It's very interesting. I was talking with people at Planned Parenthood who said that they have repeatedly requested a meeting with Attorney General John Ashcroft around the issue of the terrorism targeting women's health clinics around the country. And even to this day, with the 100 anthrax letters, which turned out not to be positive, test positive for anthrax, have not received communication from Ashcroft himself. Now, some might say, well, they were hoaxes, but the hoaxes that have been dealt with in the media have been taken very seriously, with many senators and Ashcroft himself saying that they will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law because they create terror. They make people afraid. We're not finding that with the clinics and the letters that are sent to them, that they're getting much of any attention.
We have we've received anthrax threats in the clinics at least for the last 4 years, our particular clinic. And on the day that, the very day that the rest of the country received anthrax threats on Monday of last week, or Monday and Tuesday last week, our clinics received over 170 threats. And we reported them also. Now all of these have checked out, and I believe I just talked to someone last night that they think now that there's possibly maybe even 200 clinics on that very day or those 2 days in the beginning of the week that received anthrax threats and were closed down, or people had to leave the building for many hours until the police could sweep it. And if nothing else, it ties up our law enforcement people and our emergency response teams chasing myths, while the real foreign terrorists can have less time and energy devoted to their activities. So.
Well, before we go to break, and then afterwards, we'll be joined by the producer of the movie Soldiers in the Army of God, as well as Fred Clarkson, who is a well-known researcher into the right. We're going to play an excerpt of the documentary, and this is Paul Hill, who is now on death row in Florida, who gunned down a doctor who provided abortions. He was just driven into the women's health clinic compound in the driveway with a couple who had picked him up at the airport. And this is Paul Hill describing how he opened fire.
Directly between me and the abortionist. So the first three shots were almost directly at, they were directly at the driver, and I think he absorbed most of the shot. And then I ran to a tree, and I knelt behind the tree as I had planned and reloaded three rounds in my shotgun, and then raised the gun again. And at that time, the abortionist was rocking his head back and forth. I think he was trying to avoid having his head shot. And as a matter of fact, he succeeded, because my first shot missed, and I lowered my aim, and the second shot hit his body. His body reacted very violently. And then I followed that with three more subsequent shots, and he stopped moving.
That is Paul Hill describing how he killed the abortion provider in Florida, as well as the man who drove him to the clinic. You're listening to the War and Peace Report as we talk about the terror that these groups face today, and also talk about the possibility of where the anthrax threats come from. This after the break. You're listening to the Democracy Now! In Exile.
A soldier in the army of the Lord, in the army,
mighty good soldier,
in the army of the Lord, in the army.
But if you don't believe, tell Benjamin, follow me on down, I'll just see.
Yeah,
my head got so wet with the midnight dew.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a warrior, yeah.
In the army of the Lord.
Warrior.
In the army.
I'm a warrior.
In the army of the Lord.
Mighty good warrior, yeah.
In the army.
I'm a soldier.
In the army of the Lord.
I'm a soldier.
In the army.
I'm a soldier, yeah.
In the army of the Lord.
Mighty good soldier.
In the army.
You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile. We are joined on the telephone by Daniel Vohl, the producer of the film Soldiers and the Army of God. There are so many chilling moments in this documentary that you have produced. Among them, Henry Felicone, the minister and Army of God member, and Bob Loki, who is an Army of God member and ex-con who lives in Alabama and moderates the website Save the Babies. Can you tell us about them?
Well, one of the things as we made this film over the last year and a half was that we were given a kind of unprecedented access into the daily life and I think the kind of psychological profile of what it was like to find out that our neighbors, which is, you know, in a sense, there was no way to stereotype the background of any of the members of the Army of God. Some of them were 18, 19 years old. Others had been in prison. Some themselves had scientific backgrounds, but all had one bedrock belief, which was that if God told them to kill, that they would find a way to kill. And the others that we kept finding and interviewing were those who provided the philosophical and I would say kind of friendship base that sent both the messages out of hate and of intolerance, and also encouraged others and exhorted others to violence from the kind of safety of the internet where they were sending their messages out, or literally from their living rooms as they met and gathered, in this case, for a holiday gathering in which several dozen members of the Army of God gathered in St. Louis.
What we're going to hear is extremely chilling, with Henry Felicone, the minister and Army of God member, actually talking about the use of biochemical weapons. But this is what Felicone and Bob Loki, another member of the Army of God, had to say.
is Latin for little one, is either a baby or he's not. If it's not a baby, there's no objection whatsoever to abortion. It's a medical decision. If he is a baby and the abortionist is a mass murderer, and he may be stopped even by killing him, that's basically our position. So we have the Army of God, which in the future will organize and coalesce like those in Europe who have centuries of underground work, and there will be skilled assassins and skilled saboteurs after the abortion industry, which is not only the abortionists, but the people on top of them, including Supreme Court judges. Now, Paul Hill has called for Supreme Court judges to be killed, and also for chemical and biological weapons, and we support this call. At least I do. I'll have to ask the others about their position.
This is Bob Loki, or another Army of God member.
Anybody who raises a weapon up against these people who are slaughtering these babies, before God and the entire world right now, I say, you are doing God's own work, and more power to you. May the power of God be with you as you aim that rifle and as you lay it down just like that, and you look along those sights and you squeeze that trigger.
An excerpt of the movie Soldiers in the Army of God. Okay, here we have them saying it. Frederick Clarkson, your author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. What is your understanding of as federal authorities and the Homeland Security Administration look for those who might be responsible for the anthrax attacks that came a week after the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon? Is there any reason to speculate, as the mainstream media is a specialist in speculation, about the Army of God and white supremacist groups in this country?
Well, the Army of God claimed credit in their letters to accompany the threats, and that's a pretty standard device by terrorist groups to claim credit for what they did. The difficulty that we have in talking about the Army of God is that it's a name that's adopted by lots of people, because they generally, except for the above ground entity that was portrayed so well in Soldiers in the Army of God, they follow the model of leaderless resistance. And that happens with both the specifically anti-abortion Army of God, but also the more broadly white supremacist kind of components. Several years ago, Eric Rudolph pipe-bombed the Atlanta Olympics, pipe-bombed several abortion clinics and a gay bar in Atlanta, and he was a member of a white supremacist militia group and had long been involved in white supremacist activities, and he'd been mightily cheered by white supremacist groups in much the same way that Don Spitz now cheers whoever has been sending the anthrax threats. So it does get complicated. Specifically, though, in the case of the recent round of threats, the claim was the threat came from somebody at least new to me, and that's the Army of God Virginia Dare chapter. And I asked around as to who Virginia Dare might be, and at least in my research, it turns out that Virginia Dare was the first white child born in the New World of English colonists in 1587, shortly after the first colonists arrived in Roanoke. But she was also part of the group that disappeared in that first few months when a boat went back for supplies and everyone there just disappeared with barely a trace. So she does seem to have adopted kind of a mystical, legendary quality for a lot of people that could be, but it's just speculation, a white supremacist sensibility.
Daniel Vohl, we're going to play another excerpt of your documentary with Bob Loki and Jonathan O'Toole, a 19-year-old minister's son who's being trained as a soldier in the Army of God. He works now on the infamous Nuremberg Files website, which many characterize as a hit list of abortion providers. What does the Nuremberg Files website actually do?
The website is a list which young Jonathan O'Toole and others, hundreds of others, in fact, who've helped out across the country. It's a list of doctors and nurses and escorts and politicians and journalists and judges who the Army of God members, and specifically in this case Neil Horsley and Jonathan, who run the website, feel are enemies of the anti-abortion movement. And listed on the websites are often the home addresses and the working addresses of these doctors, these escorts, and their clinics. And when a doctor is killed, the name is struck out. When a doctor or escort is wounded, the name is grayed out, and it reads convincingly like a hit list.
Well, let's hear these Army of God members, the older Bob Loki, sort of talking to and counseling Jonathan O'Toole, 19 years old.
You have actually been a soldier in training within the last year. You've been deliberately put through that, both by yourself, by Neil Horsley, by me, by everybody really that you've been in contact with. You wrote me an email one time that you were right on the verge of that you were ate up with pity for these babies and you had to do something. And I felt that you were about to head off in the direction of doing something foolish, not that I would consider killing an abortionist foolish in and of itself, but I would only want you to do it in such a way that you would not be apprehended while you were doing it.
Or go off half-cocked.
Right. And that you would do it in a soldierly manner and get away with it.
I light this candle in memory of Donald L. Catron and Claudia Gilmore, both shot and wounded December 28th, 1991, in Springfield, Missouri.
This is a pro-choice group remembering the dead, the abortion providers killed by anti-choice activists.
Murdered March 1993 in Pensacola, Florida. Dr. Gunn was my friend.
In my journey right now, I may be thinking on even bigger terms. I think the Lord God is more than capable of bringing the government itself under his foot for a footstool. Yeah.
But he's not going to do that, son. He's left that up to us.
This is Bob Loki and Jonathan O'Toole of the Army of God. And now back to the pro-choice remembrance of the doctors killed.
John and James were murdered. June was wounded in July 1994.
Who wouldn't think about killing someone if you knew that someone you loved was about to be murdered? And the presence of that thought is a temptation. It's too tempting. You can't tempt young men like me beyond what we can bear. There's a point beyond what someone like me can bear when it comes to babies being killed and slaughtered. That's the point beyond which I don't know how anyone else is wired up, but the way I'm wired up and the way I've learned to love children and to protect children and to be careful with children and to change their diapers and to defend them and to do everything that would be good for them. You can't go and insert this climate of murdering children and just say, accept that and don't be tempted on a regular basis to use violence to stop it. Oh gosh, if the Lord came and said to me in some way that I knew that it was the Lord to go and do fill in the blank, I'd have to do it, you know, anything at all.
Jonathan O'Toole and Bob Loki of the Army of God talking about why they believe in violence, and it was set against a backdrop of people, pro-choice leaders, staff, doctors at clinics remembering the dead. Again, numbers that are not often talked about. 7 abortion providers have been murdered over the last 2 decades or so since 1977. There have been 17 attempted murders of clinic staff. And now Clayton Wagner, who is on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, says that since doctors are so well protected now, since they know that the threats are real, that all staff are fair game. Frederick Clarkson, I want to ask you a quick question about an issue that we're going to deal with tomorrow, and that is Larry Wayne Harris, who I saw on CNN identified as a bioterrorism expert. In fact, he is a former member or member of the Aryan Nations. They didn't say this. The federal government said he's a dangerous man with ties to white supremacists. He got and was arrested for getting bubonic plague in the mail, pleaded guilty to wire fraud after illegally obtaining 3 vials of freeze-dried bubonic plague, and then arrested in Las Vegas in an anthrax scare. How does he fit into this picture?
Well, he's being treated as an expert in the media by a lot of people now because of his experience.
And yet they're not identifying him.
He's a con man, and a lot of people are falling for it.
What's astounding, I was just speaking with Chip Berlay, who was saying it's as if you were interviewing Timothy McVeigh and calling him an explosives expert. But the fact that right now all of the emphasis in terms of the anthrax scare is looking abroad and at other countries. Daniel Vohl, as you finish this documentary, Soldiers in the Army of God, if speculation is based on what's happened in the past, would you think that it would be important to look within here in the United States?
Absolutely. We began this documentary after the death of Dr. Slepian, and as filmmakers who abhorred violence, we were continually astonished to find, you know, the equivalent of training camps in this country, of an underground railroad in this country, a delivery systems that were explored extensively by this extremist wing of an otherwise, you know, nonviolent political viewpoint, which has a place in the American debate, but there is no place for anthrax or bubonic plague or threats against doctors and their staff, and yet theologically and practically we have a growing body of potential soldiers starting at a young age being instructed here.
We only have a minute left, but Fred Clarkson, I'm talking about speculation, but on the issue of hoax, the Army of God has claimed responsibility for some of these letters. What about how the media talks about hoax?
Well, the definition of hoax is generally thought of as a practical joke or a prank. You think of a high school kid pulling the fire alarm to get out of a test. And while that might be a criminal act even, the media has used the word hoax to be dismissive of empty anthrax threats. But the fact the threats are real. In any other context, they would be called a threat of biological attack. In fact, somebody was recently indicted for a practical joke of, you know, detergent and envelope in a colleague's desk, and that was indicted for inducing panic. There's a double standard that's going on in the way that the media is reporting threats of anthrax and other things to abortion providers, and it's dismissive.
Well, I want to thank you both very much, and I look forward to hearing John Ashcroft actually talk about women's health clinics and the issue of terror that they face. Frederick Clarkson, author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy, and Daniel Vohl, producer of the film Soldiers in the Army of God. He wrote the piece The Future of the Armed Abortion Movement for Esquire in February of 1999. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our technical director. Errol Maitland's at the helm at WBIX.org, where you can hear Democracy Now!, as well as at democracynow.org and webactive.com. Thanks to Amy Pomerlow at KPFA and affiliate station KFCF in Fresno, all the Pacifica affiliates. We are Pacifica. Thanks to the Downtown Community Television Center, where we're broadcasting from. We are in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend, every box got a right to be booming, because the streets are alive with the sound of boom bop. Can I hear it once again? Boom bop. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend, every flower got a right to be booming. Be resistant the negativity, we keep it at a distance. Call for backup and I give you some assistance.
like a lifesaver deep in the ocean. Stay afloat here upon the funky motion. Rock and roll upon the waves of the season. Hold your breath and your underwater breathing. To be rhyming without a real reason is to claim but not to practice a religion. If television is the drug of the nation, satellite is immaculate reception. Beaming in, they can look and they can listen. So you see, don't believe in the system to legalize you or give you your freedom. You want rights? Ask them, they'll read them. But every flower got a right to be blooming. Stay human, because the streets are alive with the sound of boom bap. Can I hear it once again? Boom bap. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend, every box got a right to be booming, because the streets are alive.